Blog Talk Radio.
Golden dreaming beauty man, is it only fantasy? Sometimes one can't help but wonder, will it ever truly be? Some people keep on saying, all is illusion and lies. Why is it so hard to believe there are better days to see? So it seems like the world is tumbling down. It's the darkest time of night. Right before
blessings to us, we're alive because we want to stay alive. In Torah Chaim, instructions of life, Torah Chesed, Torah Kindness, Torah Rachmim. This is now the 230th class of Soul Class, in search of ancient authentic Torah, class number 58, which is very interesting because 58 is the numerical number which corresponds to Noach, and we're trying to deal with also as well, not just the Torah Vizel, the Torah of the Bnei Noach, the instructions for all peoples. It's making a more pleasant world. Before we do it, we're going to turn down the music of Blessed Brother, prayer leader, and soul spirit Isaac Gitton from his Generation Redemption album. Here comes the time, and there it comes, and there it goes. Sorry, Rabbi Isaac, great to cut you off, and you can hear him live every morning at the Frankel Shul leading congregation, as it is Jewish tradition that one leads the congregation in the morning, afternoon, and evening prayer for 11 months when one has lost a parent. And Rabbi Isaac lost his blessed father, lived many years in Morocco, and then made Aliyah. As we say, he ascended up to the land of Israel, and now is somewhere ascending in the land of the living in the Garden of Eden. With that being said, let's also, before we bring in our co-host Dennis Ryan, let's give you a brief preview of what we hope to cover tonight with all humble efforts. And here we go. Blessed is our Creator, blessed souls. Adam and Eve are portrayed as being naked, yet not yet ashamed, yet not ashamed, as written in Genesis chapter 2, verse 25, quote, and they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed, end of quote. We should take note, there is nothing wrong, or is there anything pornographic in this description of where they were holding in their prophetic minds, and we plan on summoning up a prophetic verse which also calls attention to another type of nakedness. Hint, hint, blessed souls, please go see Ezekiel chapter 16, verses 6 and 7, where we can vibe out on that and hopefully connect those dots together. As well, we hope to vibe out on teachings from Rambam about him and a brief biographical look at this Torah scholar. Plus, we plan to share from some Chabad and Breslov Chassidus, Duties of the Heart from Ben Yabachia, The Path of Rise Gentle, in addition to Compassion for Humanity in the Jewish Tradition. Oh yeah, one more plus. Whatever comes down the pipeline of live human dialogue when we connect to our divine image, which helps us get off the scrimmage, Hartzelem Elohim is no dream. Hope you can call in if you feel that you would like to contribute to make it a more live and organic dialogue at 1-347-838-8669. That's 1-347-838-8669. Meanwhile, may you and your loved ones be blessed with a wondrous day in the infinite Creator's creation. Now we'll bring on our co-host, our teacher and student of Rambam, an activist and advocate for the dissemination of the teachings of Moses Ben Maimon, Maimonides. Good evening, Sir Dennis Ryan.
Good evening, Don. How are you?
Thank God, and we are filled with joy that we were able to survive Hurricane Sandy, and unfortunately, and we offer public lamentations for those who lost loved ones. And also for the rampant destruction, in particularly in the New York City area where both of us are hailing from at this particular time. And we hopefully will see very much in the near future that the human family experience in the five boroughs and in the 21 states in the United States of America and across the country, across the continents, will realize that we shouldn't have to wait for disasters to come together. We should come together to avert, hopefully, future disasters. I'd like to share with you, Dennis, and you blessed listeners out there, blessed souls, a story I heard, a very brief depiction of at least one attitude that was able to take the lemon that she was given and turn it and squeeze it into lemonade. Her name is Jennifer Jeffries. Now, I don't know Jennifer Jeffries, and I did not know, and I probably will never meet her. She's a 37-year-old woman who lives out in Little Ferry, New Jersey. Now, I know of Little Ferry because my father used to live in, I believe it's in adjacent town, Monaki, New Jersey, when he worked for Milner Sprinkler Companies in the from the 60s up until the, I think, the early 2000s. And Jennifer Jeffries lost her house and was flooded out, and many of her neighbors had their houses flooded because Little Ferry happens to be on a low plain of earth, and it's close to the Hackensack River, and the levees, the levees broke, and the whole that vicinity that she lived in was decimated. Now, what happened to be that after the storm, she had quieted down. And she and her family, from the interview that was done with a very brief interview, that she has a family with a husband and children, that they were evacuated to a shelter and happened to be also on the occasion of her 37th birthday. So she sounded a little bit euphoric, which sometimes when people are overwhelmed by a tragic circumstance, and certainly losing one's home is a tragic circumstance under any circumstances, that she remarked, although they lost everything, there's still life. And then she remarked, oh, and later today I'll be celebrating my 37th birthday and is in a shelter with 250 people. So the interviewer said to her, oh, well, you have a bigger birthday party. So she said, there you go. And she kind of laughed, and that was the end of the interview. And I thought of this courageous soul being able to stand up to the pressure of probably could potentially trigger what is known as a post-traumatic stress syndrome of losing one's house. I think that's something that would qualify as causing someone to break down. And we can even say justifiably so. We can't judge anyone who breaks down when they lose their life possessions. That she was able to, first of all, recognize there's life. And when there's life, there's hope. And then when being told that she can celebrate her birthday with 250 people, most of them probably not intimate friends, but, you know, associates, maybe some family members, but basically strangers, said, yeah, we'll make it. There you go. So I take that as a nice, indication, Dennis, of the strength of the human spirit connected to the divine image, devoid of any proclaimed spirituality, religiosity, faith-based cognitive awareness. Just this is what a human being is. We deal with tragedies on different levels, but here is a young woman, 37 years old, who sounds like, yes, she's been dealt a blow, but she's ready to move on. Any comments about what I just reflected on?
Yes. A lot of people have their heads screwed on straight, and they realize from common sense that everything that's man-made, everything that's basically on the planet, is temporary. It will not last forever. Anybody living in a floodplain has to be acutely aware. Even when they buy the land today, it's required that you have to sign off that you acknowledge that you live in a floodplain, and you can't get you can't get regular insurance for flood. You got to get separate insurance for that. So we're not hiding it, and people who live along a river always are aware that the river it can rise a bit. So it becomes a question, will it happen to you? Can it happen to you? Are you strong enough to withstand this? So people who deal with a closeness of Mother Nature, as opposed to the people who live in big cities and concrete canyons, we feel like we're protected. What is it going to do? It can't knock down the Empire State Building. We've had movies that show you that, oh, sure, you can freeze over and these other things, but we know there's a common sense approach to this. But there's a lot of people, regardless of their religion, know that if you live for another day, there is hope. And that hope depends on you because it's your perception of what the new day will bring. Mm-hmm. It won't bring an old day back. It's a new day. And you're part of the new concept. If you can't quickly switch your thinking, you're going to be buried in despair. You won't want the new day to come through. But remember, everything here on the planet is temporary.
True. Dennis, thank you for that. And also I want to reflect on a couple of things I heard during the week last week. Because I thank the Most High that our vicinity that we live in Kessler Crown Heights, Brooklyn, New York, our lights flickered. But basically we had no diminishing of our essential services. I know my family out in Jersey, my brother out in Butler, New Jersey, lost his power for 4 days. But before the past Sabbath, he was able to return with his family back to their humble abode. And my parents basically turned their house into Camp Goodman for my brother and sister-in-law and their two children. And they resumed life. And my parents, I think the greatest inconvenience they had was they lost their cable connection to OptumNet or whatever because of the wires being down. But then what I heard, some of the descriptions, particularly from Brian Lehrer, WNYC, New York City, AM and FM radio, was that there is a new term. I guess with every new human experience, new terms pop up. So there was a term I never heard before, maybe you've heard of it, called cell phone vagabonds, meaning that those who were trapped in lower Manhattan and had no essential services were literally walking around with their cell phones trying to find an oasis, so to speak, to charge up their cell phones. Just showing how, you mentioned this last week, Dennis, how sometimes man is reminded by the Almighty how puny we are. And despite the fact that my personally family from here to New Jersey were not adversely affected, aside from the inconvenience of now trying to wait to get gas, I do not feel any sense of victory. I feel a sense of mourning. I feel a sense of loss. But I am comforted by what I've heard in the last 48 hours, Dennis, is the outpouring of public concern being voiced by athletes, politicians, lay people. And I want to tell you about an interesting telephone call I engaged in on this Friday before the Sabbath. He happens to be, he described himself, I won't say his name, he's a Facebook friend, because he hinted to me he wanted his name not disclosed. But he happens to be someone who calls himself a monotheist who lives out in Ohio, who is connected to an organization that distributes food. Now, he told me that as of Friday night, this past Friday night, 12 o'clock in the morning, that he was going to be driving an 80-foot truck towards the five boroughs to distribute food in different areas. And we even tried to work out the logistics where he could have joined me for a Sabbath meal, and eventually he wants to make some connections with a Lubavitch rabbi down in Florida, and I directed him to Rabbi Shalom Lipsker, who is one of the more successful emissaries of Lubavitch. May his merits protect us, because he's not only involved in teaching Torah to normative Jews, he's also involved in trying to help Jews who have been jailed for whatever crimes they've committed against society, try to help them adjust to regular living. And this person was so, how should we say, Dennis, he was so matter of fact that this is what we do, we got to help people. And I think this is what separates us from historical Sodom and Amorah, because I heard some very negative statements coming from the Middle East. I'm not going to say which faith, where they were saying, oh, America, this, you deserve it. And I heard other people make criticisms. I think it's high time that we recognize, Dennis, and from my own humble opinion, and I'm just saying it's my humble opinion, that it's not about judging other people for why they suffer, but encouraging them, hopefully, to do what's right to avoid more trying circumstances. Any comments on these matters?
Well, we are warm-blooded people who have feelings. We're called sentients because we have senses. But when someone needs help, even if you don't know them, you feel a tug. You feel a little magnetic pull that maybe you should help them. Maybe it's part of your world to help someone who needs help. So we're not devoid of it. It's just that some people will have good intentions. Others, again, will do good deeds. So we feel it, even though we don't show it all the time. But it's there. And if we do nothing, our guilt feelings will remind us later on that you didn't do anything. You could have, but you didn't. If you can't, then there shouldn't be any guilt feelings, even though you may feel bad. So don't confuse the feeling bad with the guilt feelings. One is a physical thing, the other is a moral position. Sometimes people try to say that. But to say that something bad happened to you because you deserve it, no, that's not true. Everything happens for a purpose. I like to believe every human thing can be logically understood. But the limit of how far you can go, because we can only understand what our minds can handle. So therefore, we still believe that even though Mother Nature is out there doing some tough things to humans, it makes us stronger and it has a reason for being there. But Mother Nature on the whole protects us at the same time. So therefore, it's an ambivalent feeling, or it's an ambivalent condition, that it helps us and can hurt us. That doesn't mean because we press the wrong button, it's going to hurt us. So for those people who like to give opinions as to why you're having a hard time, that, I think, is because they're not taking care of their own business.
I hear you. And Dennis, I just want to mention before we bring our next co-host, I think that also we have to remind people that Mother Nature does only according to what the Father of all creation, Almighty God, tells her to do, and that she's not an independent agent. And for those who think that she's an independent agent, are falling into the category of acknowledging that there's a power outside of the Almighty Creator. With that being said, I believe we have Booker T. Washington Business League President Karchel Gore. Is that you, sir?
Yes, me, right here. Rep Tov, how are you?
Shalom, Karchel. Karchel, I'm assuming that you've been keeping abreast of the, you know, what happened before, during, and after the devastation of Hurricane Sandy. Do you have any stories that you think might be interest to the listeners out there that could strengthen their faith or give them a little hope over? I mean, I think that, you know, for what happened, it could have been much worse. But perhaps you heard something that will give people a little insight for those outside the New York City area, some anecdote that caught your mind's eye.
Well, in my part of Flatbush, you wouldn't know there was a hurricane. Because I heard the howling winds, but when I went outside twice during the hurricane, it was just intermittent wind and intermittent rain, and it was no big deal, just leaves on the ground. And you wouldn't know there wasn't a scratch on the car. You wouldn't know that there was a hurricane.
Mm-hmm.
But when I walked a few blocks over, I saw that people had lost their cars, their houses, their garages. And then I heard stories on the news. That were quite distressing. I heard like they were both 24 years old, and they were walking their dog in the calm of the storm when a tree tipped over and killed them both. And when I went to work, I discovered that the female of that couple is the cousin of the food service worker in one of the schools where I work.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So, but what happened was we shared our stories at work, and then we got up and hugged each other, you know, because we were happy. We were happy that even though some people lost all their possessions, they still had their lives. And that's the most important thing. And, you know, it didn't matter what faith you were or race. I mean, I was hugging a woman who was a Bengali Muslim, you know. I'm sure some of them were Catholic and whatnot. And it doesn't matter. We're all children of the Creator, and we should care about each other.
Amen. I hear you. My one disappointment, General, I'd like you both to maybe reflect on it briefly if you can, that, you know, I made a statement at work and someone kind of jumped on me. I said, you know, potentially this could have worse consequences than, say, 9/11. And maybe that's a little polemic on my part, but the point I was trying to make is I remember, I think it was in a week or two after the 9/11 terrorist attack, that there was a gathering at Yankee Stadium of 50,000 plus of different faith-based viewpoints to pray for healing and for those souls who have been lost, and we know it was over 3,000. Now, we didn't lose over 3,000 souls, but I think there is definitely a genuine need for healing, and hopefully it, you know, thank God we didn't lose 3,000 people like in 9/11, but I think the Almighty is giving us a golden opportunity to take the human family experience, the brotherhood, the sisterhood, the humanhood, to the next level, that hopefully the 5 boroughs and hopefully the 21 states and the rest of the country, and then hopefully the rest of the world can learn from this, that from out of tragedy shall arise. And I'm being the optimist, that hopefully there will be a new way of looking at life, more out of appreciation and extending one's hand without needing government intervention, without needing to be told by a politician my position is the right way, but rather because people will sense that we're either going to make it together or we're going to fall together. Dennis, your take on my idealistic optimism.
I'm glad how you diplomatically worded that, Don, because I could understand why some of your coworkers took objection to what you said. 9/11 occurred because people wanted to do evil and they wanted to take human lives. The storm we just had was, I'd say, a quirk of nature. Doesn't happen every day. It happens occasionally. Sometimes it takes years. Sometimes it takes centuries. But it happens from time to time. But in this case, people were warned well ahead of time to protect themselves, days ahead of time. And even the height of the water was predicted for those who lived on the coastline. So if you are a hermit and you have no communications with any other humans, I could understand you may be surprised or even shocked. But other than that, the two events cannot be talked about on a parallel basis, because nature is not evil in and of itself, while the people who constructed the 9/11 Holocaust or catastrophe at the time, wanted to kill as many humans as they want, okay? So I understand what you wanted to say, but the people who were listening to you at work took it a little differently, but I'm surprised you didn't understand that viewpoint, Don, because...
Well,
I mean, we're lucky that it didn't turn into something worse. Any catastrophe, any crisis, we don't want it to turn into something else. That's a standard sentiment that everybody can understand, but there's a motive involved. If there was no motives, you'd be absolute. No one would disagree with you. But there were motives, and some people feel bad about that. I'm not saying you don't. I'm just saying that taking that comment out of context would cause a little rumble or muttering somewhere.
Cartrell, you're taking this, and then I'll make a response, and we can counter respond. And you'll understand. Perhaps the thing I didn't clarify at office and at my office, and I haven't clarified now, I'll try to clarify putting it under an umbrella, which I think you can link the two things together. Yes, Cartrell, your take on this.
It just reminded me of my nephew who lives in Coney Island, who lives in a flood zone. And he refused to evacuate, even though he was told to evacuate. And unfortunately, his car's engine was flooded in the parking lot. I mean, had he parked his car rear end first, as was the car next to his car would have been spared because he more than entered the engine. But I don't know. Sometimes, you know, I think I feel more comfortable taking my chances in my home, which I did this time, as opposed to moving away. But I don't live in a flood zone. He does live in a flood zone.
Mm-hmm. I hear you. So let me just requalify, and something I should have mentioned at work, and I guess I should have mentioned at the beginning here too. Two points that I think tie together 9/11 with Hurricane Sandy. Number one, they're both under the umbrella of a tragedy. Number two, in both cases, one was man-made, one was the forces of nature directed from a higher nature above us. Things could have been much worse. And my concern is, of course we don't want either tragedy to ever occur again, but we can't guarantee that, only God can. But that the idea that it struck me back then, and I've mentioned on previous shows that it is still a source of disappointment that there's not monthly gatherings or bi-monthly or even yearly gatherings, aside from the ceremonial gatherings at Ground Zero, where there's, you know, different faith-based groups are gathering together. And I think now, too, it is a time for healing. Even so shortly after this, it is a tragedy. I do consider it to be a tragedy, even though it's nature-driven, and that hopefully someone will be aroused to gather groups of people far more influential than the whatever small influence we can have doing our humble efforts here on the radio to gather together to summon a trumpet call for greater unity, regardless, just as Cartrell mentioned before, he hugged a Muslim woman and a person of the Catholic faith. So I think certain issues are just beyond categories of people. And perhaps I should have mentioned that at the office, and I guess I should have mentioned at the beginning here. Dennis, your final remark on this subject.
Oh, I agree with your intention, Don. To me, you're always golden, and you don't have an evil bone in your body, so therefore you're trying to get to the truth like we all are. However, you got to remember that humans forget about things and quickly are distracted. We've had major wars on Earth here, even the American Civil War, World War I, World War II, the Korean War, where a lot of people have died. What we do is we erect memorials until our memory forgets about them. And then we start it all over again. Human memory is very short. And we keep repeating this over and over. And we don't think that a natural disaster sometimes is as bad as a human-made disaster. Yet, we forget about it and keep on going. But when do people remember? When the next crisis happens. And now we have something to compare. But those who were here on the planet for the last crisis should know better. But it's like beginning or starting all over. Humans are short-sighted. It's part of our imperfections. So that's why we have these programs that we're talking now to remind people that there is a constant There is something that you can rely on, and there is something that you can look forward to, and that is called Hashem, Almighty God, the Lord, whatever you want, as long as it's not disrespectful. But that is our source. Your lights can come and go. The sun goes home at night. But your mind is always alert, and God is ever present. If the sun never shone again, does that mean you give up about God? Of course not. We need something to survive. And it's not only physical survival, but mental survival.
True. With that being said,
gentlemen, I'd like to
yes,
add
Petra,
that.
Please. Yes, please.
I'd like
please.
To add that you compared Hurricane Sandy to 9/11, which was a terrorist attack. One thing you should know about natural disasters is that terrorists do their recruiting, their best recruiting, after a natural disaster, after a flood, a tsunami, and people are homeless. Al-Qaeda, which has lots of money, goes out and does rescue missions and gains recruits that way. In fact, I think Al-Qaeda also offered to give aid to New York City last week. Some terrorist organization
really?
Offered. It's their Muslim duty, yeah. But that's how they get recruits. After a national earthquake or some national disaster,
you're correct.
Yes, Dennis.
It was Iran who said that they were going to offer help for New York due to the disaster. But Goodrell brought up a good point. It's sometimes the man-made crisis or any type of crisis produces reasons to convince people that they should go ahead and take revenge, or they should offset this, or go after the bad guys, or whatever it is. And you take people who are living out near the desert, up in deserted mountains, and all of a sudden we drop bombs on them. Well, if they were a family who were collaterally damaged, and they only have a couple of people left, sure, they're going to want to go ahead and join a terrorist organization to get even. So what happens is, in a lot of cases, evil begets evil, and the devil is very happy about that. But we have to stop that chain reaction by going to the heart of things, and that is more people, as Don said, should get together for good reasons, and those good reasons must be done on a regular, frequent basis, not just when crises happen, because how are you going to avoid the bad feelings after a crisis if you're not set up ahead of time?
True. And when crisis is human driven, unfortunately, without naming cultures, there are cultures that exist in the world that a crisis could have happened 50, 60, 100 years before, but their cultural backgrounds, which are so old, are that they will actually seek, they could wait another 50, 100 years before they take revenge, and how sweet their revenge will be, even if the longer they wait, and the more intense revenge they inflict on others. So, you know, this is a very serious matter, which cuts to the core of, civilizations in conflict, and what we're trying to do through our humble efforts, you know, with these mere words, is to inspire more and more people that, you know, there comes a certain point where revenge won't solve the problems of the world. But with that being said, gentlemen, we have another category of people, aside from people wanting to take revenge, we have a category of people called skeptics, and I want to segue to a letter that the Lubavitch Rebbe responded to, actually from a Jewish skeptic, and this was written in 1959, his response to someone who written a letter with a frank question to the Rebbe. Is there any way that we, as Jews, as skeptical Jews, I mean, thank God I don't consider myself as a skeptic, but there are people that will come out and say we are skeptical of the authentic teachings of the Torah, we're skeptical of spirituality, we're even skeptical of the concept of the Almighty, or we're just agnostic, we're skeptical in being agnostics. But anyway, is there any that we skeptics can be utterly convinced of the existence of God without equivocation or the possibility of equivocation? So the Rebbe basically responded that you're asking for a proof, but I'd like to give you two axiomatic type of reasonings. And then he goes on, and we'll see where the Rebbe goes with this. First of all, the Rebbe said, axiom number one, man in general is generally more deeply influenced by his feelings and convictions than the conclusions he arrives at logically. And axiom number two, the intellect is nothing but an external garment. It is most effective to address the soul, and not necessarily via the intellect. Indeed, we see in our own experiences that feelings more deeply influence the soul than the intellect. Now, the Rebbe went on to say that I want to let you know that I regard the Rebbe addressing to that Jew representing a group of Jews who were skeptics, that I regard you as a group of Jews for whatever their logical conclusions might be, believe in justice and integrity. That sounds good. Indeed, they believe strongly enough to make sacrifices, including sacrifices in their personal lives for the sake of justice and integrity, and for the sake of aiding one fellow, especially when the need is not only of a single individual, but of a society great in number and quality. Thus, discarding the inhibitions imposed by the wording of your question, I allow myself to turn to you heart to heart with the following words. I see from your letter that you are young at least in verve and vigor, young also in the sense that you are capable of challenging the most prevalent norms and making drastic changes in your lives. If only you were to be convinced of the necessity to do so. Surely your world outlook includes the awareness of what our people have experienced in recent years during the Holocaust and the decrees of annihilation, when several million of our people were killed in the war years, and on the other hand, of the emergence of new roles for our people that were non-existent or that existed only in limited form up until now. So surely that you're also aware that the blurring of principles and the confusions of minds have not lessened in our generation, but on the contrary have increased alarmingly. Darkness is called light, and the bitter is lauded as sweet with extreme fanaticism, to the point that thousands and millions are literally compelled to accept darkness as light and bitterness as sweet. At such a time, the call resounds to the inner core of every Jewish soul. It is not enough to fulfill your personal duty. You must act instead in of the finest and most potent of our people annihilated. You basically be in the place of those who were annihilated in the Holocaust. You must become frontline activists who not only combat the above-mentioned breakdown in values, but also disseminate the eternal values of our people, the Jewish nation, decisively, energetically, and with youthful vigor, so that you serve as a spark that kindles the soul flame of all those in your surroundings. Is now the time for polemics? In the meantime, irretrievable days, weeks, months, and years go by, and opportunities which shall never return are now lost. If this call is addressed to every man and woman, it is addressed with even greater urgency to the youth and young adults whose role is most crucial. The younger generation is far more accepting of and far more influenced by words of direction, inspiration coming from people of their own age, and those voiced by an older person. As I said, I do not intend to logically prove what these internal values are of our people are and what is the nature of the new roles that have emerged. I rely on each of you to recognize on your own when you open the book of Jewish history, a history that stretches without our interruption over thousands of years, saturated with blood and persecution as no other, and with challenges the like of which, or anything remotely resembled them, no other nation or people have experienced. And when you study Jewish history, you'll only find that one set of values which have been preserved through the generations to this day without alteration. It is not a question of proof. These are facts, events, and deeds that irrefutably attest that not language, nor dress, culture, or external lifestyle, nor political or economic systems are our eternal values. For these have undergone many and extreme changes from time to time, from place to place. What has remained steadfast and unchanged in all times and places is the Torah, our guide to life, and the practice of the commandments in daily life, which are the eternal essence of Israel. And I just want to mention parenthetically, blessed souls, that you know the Rebbe was talking to a person who apparently was maybe the head of a student group, or a person maybe in their late 20s or early 30s, calling himself on the behalf of others as a Jewish skeptic. But I think this also has universal application, because I am not one of those type of Jewish people who say that only 6 million Jews were killed in the Holocaust. We do know that there were 6 million Noahides or Gentiles killed during the Holocaust, and 60 million people perished, as well as many people perished in the purges of the Stalinist regime in communist Russia. So the thing is, though, you know, getting on with what we talked about earlier, and I'm hoping Dennis will elaborate on this in any form that he feels is fitting, the idea that polemics is not the way to go, and that, you know, time is so precious. And I think for myself, just personally, over what we experienced over the last week, time has become a little bit more precious. I don't shy away from sharing the views that I do, but at the same time, too, I'm willing to hear views that are like mine and not like mine, but the sense that still, because the more we see our differences and likenesses among each other, the dialogue opens up, the more transparent things become between human beings, as politicians like to talk about making government transparent, that we have a better chance of making it a better world. Dennis, I bit off a lot, but I'm sure you can digest it and give back feedback that will help the digestive process for those who heard what I just said.
Well, I can give my direct views on this now. And I think the rabbi, when he was writing that, didn't want to disturb anything. On the other hand, I can disturb a lot. And I'm not trying to be funny or anything like that, but the way the rabbi presented it, it was a little too nice. I think we have to get down to bare bones when we talk to humans. And let me begin with skepticism. And that is, between the human world and the Almighty's world is a big gap. Mm-hmm. We fill it up, me, you, and probably most of the listeners, as well as Quattrell. We fill it up with faith and belief. If you don't have enough faith and belief, you're going to be skeptical. What else can you do? Do you really think your human mind is going to explain everything? Horse feathers. It's not going to happen. Even if you were Einstein, you don't know everything. You'll never even come close to it. So the gap right. between humans and the Almighty is based on faith and belief. If it isn't strong enough, you're going to let skepticism start creeping into your thinking. And if it does, all of a sudden, you're going to end up with a lot more questions than you have answers. And you're going to satisfy your human curiosity that you can create more questions than there are answers. That just goes and proves that you're low in faith and belief. You must have something that unites everything together, that brings it together and makes you whole. You cannot separate yourself from the entire universe, the entire earth. God's world is here. We are parts of it. Only parts. And if we're not reminded of that, then we're going to let skepticism come in and say, well, why doesn't he take care of us? You're going to come out with a whole series of questions that no one's going to be able to answer. And if you're just feeding your ego, you're wasting your time and everybody else's. Put your ego aside and use your mind and let common sense prevail.
Thank you, Dennis. And speaking about skepticism or skeptics, one of the ways that we can reduce this unfortunately not spiritually healthy quality of being skeptical or skepticism is to turn now to Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon, Moses Maimonides, physician, scientist, and philosopher. So, Dennis, can we please segue from... Again, Moses Maimonides, physician, scientist, and philosopher, edited by Dr. Fred Rosner and Dr. Samuel S. Kotek. What page should we go to, sir?
Hang on 1 second, Don. Okay.
Yes. I like hanging around with you. It's okay.
Page 147. And this is this was a paper that was presented by David J. Eisenman regarding Maimonides' philosophic medicine. What it is, or David J. Eisenman is a full-time physician, or he was at one time, for the neck and the head at Yale University Hospital. So he wrote this presentation that he made, and I'm going to read an excerpt from it, okay?
From the first paragraph or the second paragraph?
From the middle of the paragraph on page 147.
I'm there.
Okay. Did Maimonides consider the study of basic physiological principles to be part of medicine, as did Galen? Or are these principles, by definition, included in the second part of Maimonides' Divine Science, which deals with fundamental principles and causes of all sciences? Considering his general aversion for discussing matters of philosophy and divine science with doctors, the fact that Maimonides does not deal with some fundamentals of physiology in Perkei Moshe indicates that these principles are indeed an integral part of medical science. be that as it may, if a student of medical philosophy, physiology, contains insights into these fundamental principles from a study, they are willy-nilly a part of the corpus of medicine regarding of their strict classification. An examination of some of Maimonides' other works to see some of the parts of practice and the study of medicine play in his thought will give us a better understanding of medicine's broad functions and goals. Medicine certainly played the role of the practical part in Maimonides' life regarding the time he spent in the study of medical science. The practice of medicine as a profession took up a vast amount of Maimonides' time. Heschel believes medicine's greatest function is a practical art and sees it in the fulfillment of medicine's great function as a practical art. Hang on a minute. Okay, it's a practical art.
I think you read it.
Right. Yeah, I'm sorry, I just ran over it. There are many difficulties with this. Oh, no, all right. Heschel believes that the medicine's greatest function is a practical art and sees it in the fulfillment of the ultimate goal of converting the contemplative life into one of hesed, loving kindness. There are many difficulties with this explanation, but we still cannot deny that one respect medicine is simply a practical art. It is clear, however, that the importance of medicine for Maimonides goes far beyond the role as a practical art. Maimonides studied the science of medicine long before his brother's death forced him to take it up professionally. Xenophon describes the young man with intellectual interests as having, in quotes, already brought a whole library with books on architecture, geometry, astronomy, and above all, medicine, unquote. Aristotle talks of the, quotes, medically cultured person in his Politics. For the medical philosophers as well, and Maimonides in particular, the study of medicine as a theoretical art was an important step on the road to the ultimate perfection. In this respect, we see medicine in many different roles and encompassing many fields. One simple role, as such, is a methodological tool. Medicine, like any other valid science, as Maimonides writes in his first selection, in his first section of the guide, functions as a tool, like logic, in training the mind to think properly. Just as Plato used the model of medical science to develop the sciences of ethics and politics, and Aristotle uses medicine as a paradigm for the method of applying universal rules to particular individuals, Maimonides frequently uses medicine as a methodological paradigm. Medicine also plays an important role as a theoretical philosophy, as part of physics and even metaphysics. Here, medicine is not merely a prerequisite or propaedeutic diuretic, but itself an active part of these sciences. Maimonides defines physics as the study of physical bodies not caused by man, found in nature, minerals, plants, and living creatures. Physics also deals with accidents, properties, and causes of such bodies, as well as the necessary traits of time, place, and motion that accompany them. Aristotle writes in De Sensu that, quotes, it behooves the physical philosopher to obtain also a clear view of the first principles of health and disease inasmuch as they cannot exist in lifeless things, unquote. The author of the Hippocratic Treatise on Ancient Medicine even goes further than this and writes, in quotes, I do not believe that any clear knowledge of nature can be obtained from any source other than the study of medicine, unquote. Although Maimonides would not agree that the study of medicine is the only way of gaining knowledge of nature, he would argue that such a study an important role in search for knowledge. In the commentary on the Mishnah, on Pisium, Maimonides writes that medicine is based on the nature of all that exists, i.e. physics. This idea is underscored in the treatise, The Regimen of Health. in a discussion firmly based firmly on Maimonides' comments in De Sensu, Maimonides writes that most medical failures are due to the physician's ignorance about nature. Since it integrates and reflects the principles of nature, medicine is part of physics itself, and its study is the study of physics. Furthermore, since he writes in many places in the guide that there is no way to apprehend God except through the things he has made, certainly the study of nature of God's ultimate creation, the one he created in his likeness, must be significant to this end.
I mean, I was not aware of the fact that from Maimonides' days onward, already there was a talk of physics. Perhaps it had another term which translated into English, or maybe this author here, David Eisenman, has sort of modernized the term. What's your take on this? Was there a consideration of what we would call physics today, back in those days, or is he just translating something?
Like he wrote the Mishnah Torah, he rearranged and reclassified the categories that the Greeks had set up for what is science and what is art. He came through and said, whoa, wait a minute. Your definitions and the points that separate one from the other are rearranged the wrong way. And what he did is he came back and reestablished from his viewpoint where medicine plays a part in a lot more, and it's partly science and partly art. So what he did, just like he created index and codified things from a Judaic viewpoint, he also did that to the scientific world by breaking out things in different categories. Now, he was really bitten about creating different categories. Some people would say he might have been a little hyper about it. But what he did was he logically redistributed what the category should be, and that's basically what is taught today in most colleges and universities. It's not taught in grammar schools and high schools, but in places of higher learning, yes, what is science is different than what is physics. One may be a subset of the other, but it's interrelated to other programs, other situations, and must be considered that you cannot just say one big umbrella is going to cover everything. In effect, there's a bunch of little umbrellas that have to be recollected and understood that when you talk about physical things, you cannot exclude God.
Beautiful, Dennis. Now we're going to segue to a historical viewpoint of Rambam, Moshe ben Maimon. But for the second week in a row, we might even do it for another 2 weeks, we're going to focus actually, you know, he's known as Moses ben Maimon or Moshe ben Maimon. We're going to focus on his father Maimon, who himself also was a rav or a rabbi. And here's a letter of consolation that he wrote about how people should not be aroused to join in the ranks of skeptics, as we talked about earlier, skepticism, as we talked earlier in the show. And I'd like to read a brief section here and a very surprising response that I think that that people from around the world might find very, very interesting. Here we go. So Maimon, not Moshe ben Maimon, not Maimonides, but his father, exhorted victims of persecution to lay hold of the cord of the law and not loosen their hand from it. And he wrote as follows: for one in captivity is like one who is drowning. We're all almost totally immersed. The waters are overwhelming us. But the cord of ordinances of God and his law is suspended from heaven to earth, and whoever lays hold of it has hope. But he who loosens his band from the cord has no union with God, and he dies. And according to the manner of his taking hold of the cord in his relief from the fear of drowning, he who clings to it with all his hand has certainly more hope than he who clings to it with but part of it, or he clings to it with but the tips of his fingers, has more hope than he who lets it go altogether. So none are saved from the toils of captivity except by occupying themselves with the Torah or the law and its commentaries, by obeying it and cleaving to it, and by meditating there day and night, in accordance with the words of David, as he wrote in chapter 119, verse 92, in Psalms, quote, unless thy law had been my delight, I should have been perished in my afflictions, end of quote. And now here's something I want to share I found so fascinating, that the father of Rambam, Maimon, skillfully he wove into his letter the emotional elements of Judaic teachings. Quote, and sentiment, end of quote, says Yella Abrahams, I'm not exactly who he was, probably was a scholar that Maimon was quoting, quote, is perhaps the best guide for an individual in such a case of conscience as presents itself to the Jews of his day. And therefore Maimon, the father of Moshe ben of Moses, the famous Maimonides, he urged the people to pray in the Arabic language if the Hebrew tongue was not familiar to them, as he wrote in the following, because prayer is permissible in any language, and he who does not know the whole prayer should pray the abridged one of the appointed time, and not remain without prayer altogether. For those who do not join the practice of prayer and those who separate themselves from the faith altogether are alike. So here is something I find very interesting, Dennis, that here in a day where people are scared of, they have a phobia. Let's just bring back in Quattro for a second. He was off the air, now he's back on. Karchel, we'll just bring you back on. Thank you for coming back on. That we're in a discussion here where the father of Maimonides had encouraged people of the Jewish faith in his time when there was captivity and there was persecution, that if they were unable to pray in their native Hebrew tongue, that they could pray in the Arabic. And I think this shows that again, people who are open-minded realize, going back to what you mentioned before, Karchel, and what Dan mentioned before, that it's about people. And we all have to pray to the Most High. And so a person is not sufficient or proficient in one tongue or one language. He can pray in any language, which will communicate the message of what? The message of his or her inner heart to ask for mercies, to ask for justice, to ask for bounty to come upon the earth, that there should be restoration of human hope and communion and brotherhood. Dennis, what's your take on this? That the father of Rambam was not in any way embarrassed to encourage his brethren that they should reach out to the host languages of the countries they were now found in that period of the diaspora of the Jewish people.
My personal viewpoint is that the language is not as important as your communication with God is. Any way you can communicate with God takes over more precedent than what language or what exact words you use, because that's between you and your God. If you're doing it, it's a positive thing, and we encourage everybody to pray, which is a form of communication. So we actually try to impress people that you should take a couple of moments, at least during the day, to talk to them, to communicate, or at least attempt to. Now, the other part that you mentioned about his father, some of this rubbed off on his son, who had this concept or this phobia that he recognized in people, that if they didn't say that they would convert to another religion, they would lose their head. But Maimonides took the viewpoint, you can live for another day and you can come back even more stronger for your what you believe as your religion, so that you don't have to forsake your religion instead of losing your head. But if you want to, that's your personal thing. But he said, in my heart, in my soul, I am Jewish. And I'm going to stay Jewish no matter what. And being a Jew is a way of surviving. So he didn't mind saying, or acting like an Arab, or talking like an Arab, or even dressing like an Arab. He didn't deny he wasn't an Arab, which is a double negative. But he didn't come out and proclaim that Jews are bad because I'm a new Arab. He didn't come out and do any of that. He just melted into the background and said, all this is temporary, but it bothered his conscience to a certain extent. So, yes, some of this concepts or basic ideas rolled off onto his son.
Yep. Karchel, any comments on this when you're sure we're discussing?
And not right now.
Okay. That being said, Quattro and Dennis and Quattro and Bustos listening out there, we're going to segue to a song, which I think is appropriate for, unfortunately, for what was experienced over the past week. And of course, I mean, you know, unless a person's deaf, dumb, and blind, everyone knows that next week there is a national election for the next president of the United States. And I thought I would segue it with a song by that I played before by Apple Gabriel. He was a former member of the band, the reggae band, Israel Vibrations. And he did a version of Bob Dylan's The Times Are Changing with a little reggae spin. But it's, to me, it's a pleasant tune. And it's laced heavily in a pleasant and peaceful way with a lot of double entendres, which address the times we're in. But really, these times are being, that are being addressed in this song have applied to all times, because always the times are changing. So please enjoy the next 4 minutes and 14 seconds, Apple Gabriel, with The Times They Are Changing. Enjoy.
Gather round, people, wherever you roam, admit that the wonders around you have grown. Accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming, or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing. From writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that is remaining. For the loser now will be later to win. For the time, they are a change. Senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has fought. There's a battle outside and it's raging. It will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the time, they are a-changing. Come, mothers and fathers, show how to land, and don't criticize what you don't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old folks is rapidly aging. Get out of the new one. You can't lend a hand. For the time they are changing. The line it is drawn, the curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast. As the present now will later be fast. The order is rapidly fading. And the first one now will later be last.
Okay, that was Apple Gabriel, The Times Are Changing, and I hope we'll be changing with the times in a positive, pleasant, peaceful way, blessed souls. I'd like to now segue to, and by the way, I just want to mention something going back to something that Dennis commented on. I just want to personally testify out there into cyberspace that I do not feel any less Jewish in any which way or fashion by the fact that this conversation is 99.99% in English, because, again, the way I can share my views, and hopefully they're kosher views in the eyes of heaven, the Most High, and fellow human beings all with divine images, is that we have to use, like, for instance, a computer language. We have Windows now today. I mean, 25 years ago, you know, computers were more of an elitist apparatus, a tool. But now with Windows, everyone can access. So if we can spread the message through English, hey, I wish I could speak Chinese and Arabic and Spanish and whatever the language is out there, or the hundreds of languages in Africa, but I have a certain fluency in English and I have a certain fluency in Hebrew, but if I speak in Hebrew, I won't get the message across, and guess what? I'll be just talking to myself. And the whole point of a human being, hopefully in the form of a Torah activist or a spiritual activist, is to dialogue. Not to missionize, but to dialogue, yes.
Don, 2 cents. 2 cents says, that, as I believe, that the human condition never changes. But all the events around the human conditions are always changing. So are things really changing? I mean, we live our lives and we like to think we're unique. But when you come to think of it, all the humans who have walked across the earth in some way, shape, or form have come across the same problems we have had, but different events surrounding them. So to me, the human condition is a constant.
I hear you. Yep.
Yes.
Would that be?
You know, while you had the segue, the musical segue on, I went to my computer and brought up the lyrics because I really couldn't understand what that man was saying so clearly.
Mm-hmm.
I never realized that song was written by many times. I had no idea who wrote it. I knew it was done by Bob Dylan, but I didn't know he had written it. And, by the way, his real name is Robert Zimmerman.
Yes.
And up until a few months ago, I thought Ethel Merman, whose real name is Ethel Zimmerman, was Jewish, but she's not.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a surprise to me. I always thought that she was Jewish, but she isn't. But Robert Zimmerman, Bob Dylan, is Jewish. Or was, if he's still alive.
That's true. Yeah, he's still alive and kicking.
I see.
So we're going to go now.
In the middle of war in Vietnam, we had a general who was in charge of all the American troops or all the international troops, and he had a German Jewish sounding name that ended in M-A-N, and the Viet Cong and the other people thought he was the leader of the dirty Jewish devils that were trying to destroy their land in Vietnam. So they used this as a point of motivating their own troops to fight the guy who was the head Jew in pushing all the devils upon us. The man wasn't even German. He was English. It was an English name, but he was born in America. He had nothing to do with it being Jewish. But it didn't matter. As long as these people had a perception that he was Jewish, he had to be leading all these people in the war. I mean, what do you can't fight that.
Yeah, true. Yeah, the truth be told, that's you can't. And I just want to say, too, I mean, like people say, oh, you know, your name is Goodman. You must be a good man. I said, listen, I'm a work in progress, because not every person called a good man is a good man. And not everyone who has a name which implied something negative is a negative person. You know, it's these are labels. I mean, you know, there's a teaching that we shouldn't assume that the axe that the woodchopper chops in the forest is the most important thing. No, it's how the axe is used. I mean, you know, the crown of a good name that we have from the teaching of our fathers, the sages of Israel, is that a person gets a good name by prayer acts of kindness and getting some sort of knowledge of scripture, oral and written traditions. With that being said, gentlemen and blessed souls out there, we'd like to turn briefly to a teaching from Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. And hopefully this will, energize those who had a little skeptical view of maybe should they serve with all their power or not with all their power, the Most High. He says, not for sure we should serve, a person should try to serve the Almighty Creator with all of not just his power, but our power, because everything is dependent upon us, human beings, as the stewards of the earth. Because the earth was given to the stewards of the earth, to the children of man. And therefore, since we know that the Most High gave to us this earth to be stewards over it, there should be no sense of giving up in this world. Because in the end, we should know with certainty that everything will be according to the will of the Most High, may be blessed, and he will complete the process that he started by appointing us as stewards of the earth. And therefore, all that a person does, whenever a person does good, one should know that the good one does is never lost. It's always something which is sort of stored up for that person's benefit. And therefore, it behooves a person to bring himself into the attributes of savlanut, which is patience, which I didn't mention previously before I start speaking now. We're reading from a book called Erech HaPaim, which is referring to long and anger, the human attribute of patience as it relates to the divine attribute of long-standing and anger, because certainly the Most High is long-standing in anger with the history and the saga of the human race, with all of human family experience, with all its positive and negatives, and in between the positive and negatives. And truly, we should understand that we don't completely understand his ways. So since we don't completely understand his ways, and we're still being involved in acts of goodness, hopefully increasing in with greater strength and great dignity, it should not bother us that we don't understand completely the ways of the Most High. And I'm sure there are many people wondering why this tragedy took place as it did, this devastation which took place in the last week, and particularly in the five boroughs and in New Jersey and parts south of New Jersey. But for sure that we are reassured that the Most High is running the show. And therefore we can take our approach in serving him with all of our strength, with a sense of patience in our approach. Dennis or Quattrell, either one of you want to comment on this teaching?
The listeners, everybody else, we all did it. You have to take the first step. If you don't take the first step, you will come out with a lot of different reasons as to why you shouldn't. But way down deep, the step is there, and it reminds you, the step is there. You must take it. And to me, I look at it as a great staircase that leads to heaven. You may never get to the final step. You may never get halfway. But if you're not thinking about the next step, then why did you take the first step? It's not circular logic, but you must get on the right track. You must try things, and you must start somewhere. If you've been ignoring them, it's about time to change. We're not asking you to go out there and make believe you're going to change the whole world. If you could, and it's possible, we'd all cheer you on. That's not going to happen. Human history has shown that we have to scratch and scratch and scratch, but we have to take the first step and be mindful that there's a whole staircase out there.
Mm-hmm. Coach, any take on this? On person
and not
like
me. No,
okay.
Right now.
Okay. So now we're going to go now to Compassion for Humanity in the Jewish tradition, and we're going to go to Rabbi David Sears tersely discussing the prohibition, which is one of the seven Noahic commandments, the prohibition against robbery, theft, and kidnapping. And in particular, unfortunately, because of, number one, these very, I'm not excusing anyone, but we are living in hard economic times. And then we have the salt on the wound, so to speak, with the devastation of Hurricane Sandy in certain areas. I did hear that because there was a power outage in a certain bank in the Brooklyn area that it was robbed. I don't know how much was taken, but the fact it was robbed. And also in certain parts of the five boroughs, gangs have been going in places where there have not been sufficient police or military forces, and they've been ransacking certain parts of the five boroughs. But in relation to that, Rabbi Sears writes the following. The dignity of each individual is another corollary of the creation of man in God's image. In addition to causing the victim to suffer the loss of his possessions or freedom, the thief or kidnapper deprives the victim of dignity. The proliferation of theft also causes others to lose heart in attempting to better their circumstances through honest labor. The same is true of dishonest business practices. Theft destroys the concept of personal rights, without which the individual can feel secure in the world. According to the Torah, it is not enough to regret an act of theft. One must make complete restitution to the victim. Dennis, any take on this prohibition against robbery, theft, and kidnapping, and how it reduces the dignity of a person who is made in God's image?
Well, this is a two-way street, because the person who's doing this is also demeaning themselves, and they're doing it willfully. So not only are they hurting other people or interfering with their lives, they're doing it to themselves. Most of them don't understand this, but you got to remember, humans are fickle people, and if they think they can get away with something, then the evil thinking starts creeping in. They start rationalizing. Well, if I can do this, they're not going to catch me. They don't know me. I can get away with this.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, what goes around comes around, and there's always someone that's going to put two and two together and connect the dots. It may not happen today, may not happen tomorrow. That doesn't mean you're going to get away with this. On top of that, you have to deal with your own conscience. That means you're going to have to put it to sleep when you go to sleep at night. Some people just lose part of their mind worrying about all these things that their conscience is reminding them. So they'll take drugs, hoping that I won't hear this little voice telling me I did something wrong. How am I going to correct this? No, I think the full impact of doing an evil deed has never been truly and fully explained to people. We just tell kids when they were small, it's a bad thing to do. No, it's not a bad thing to do. It's an inhuman thing to do to yourself and other people.
True. That's very wise words. Cartrell, your take on this, the prohibition of kidnapping, theft, and robbery.
Well, kidnapping just is another form of theft. It's just you're stealing a person as opposed to stealing money or a car or something. It to me, it comes under just the idea of theft. Now, kidnapping may also lead to murder. You know, there's a very famous kidnapping trial when Lindbergh's son was kidnapped. Maybe I shouldn't talk about Lindbergh. He was anti-Semitic, I understand. Maybe I shouldn't talk about him. People tend to have a sense of what's right and what's wrong, you know. Here he goes with religion. Mm-hmm. You know, there are certain things you just know you shouldn't do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you. I just want to go briefly into something from Path of Argento, because I noticed I passed over a teaching from Path of the Duties of the Heart, which I do want to go tersely into before we get to the last, but certainly not least, subject matter of what we're going to be hopefully covering tonight. So in Rabbi Rogalsky and Rabbi Chaim Korfin's book, The Path of the Righteous Gentile, I don't think I've read this in the past as part of the title. It's also called An Introduction to the Seven Laws of Noah. Concerning the prohibition of idolatry, is that the rabbis strongly advise not to commission someone to make an idol for himself, even if he or she does not intend to use it. Also, it is forbidden to make an idol with one's own hands, even if the idol is meant for someone else and one does not intend to serve it. All the more so, it is forbidden to make an idol with one's own hands for oneself. So, Divya mentioned that again, within the context of a particular society, not society against society, meaning I've learned this in the oral teachings, that, for instance, a Muslim society cannot go into a Hindu society, a country with certified boundary lines, cannot invite another country to cause the to like the Hindus. I mean, I know that there have been cases in Asia where they've burnt their temples and saying that this is the will of their faith. But in fact, that according to the Seven Noahic Commandments, they're not allowed to do this, just as it was not really permissible, according from the Torah perspective, for the European Christians to come away and take away the belief system of the Indians, which were not necessarily that. I once heard that the Hopi Indians were monotheistic, but generally speaking, the Indian tribes believed in things which were in partnership with the Most High, and some were involved in actual ceremonies which would be considered to be idolatrous. With that being said, I know this type of teachings might seem to be stepping on people's intellectual, emotional, and soulful sensitivities. But again, the idea is not that we're going to start telling people to become spiritual vigilantes and going to some place X and breaking what is generally projected to be as idols or images, forbidden images, but for those who make those images to stop making those images, or for those people who are in those places of worship to have heart-to-heart discussions about perhaps it would be in their best interest on their own, of their own volition, to remove them. And I do know that, for instance, in a place called Cleveland, Tennessee, Jack Saunders is a spiritual leader down there of the Ben Noach movement down there. And when they remove certain items from their formerly Christian congregation, many people left and many people stayed. And a lot of people took great umbrage in the fact that he removed certain symbols down from inside the church. So that being said, Dennis, any comments or concerns about this type of teaching?
Yes. You cannot judge spirituality. If you have it, you can't say it's a bad thing because it's not my spirituality. Spirituality is something that's been practiced by humans long before anybody created organized religion. Why? Because humans must believe in something. There's a big gap between humanity and everything else besides that. And if you don't know about Hashem or God, then you're going to let your mind wander that there's something out there. You just don't know what it is. You don't know what to call it, but you're going to honor it. Okay. It's when we explain to you what faith and belief is that we expect you to start considering it. That way, you transfer your spirituality into what you had before into something that's a little bit more organized. So we cannot get mad at other people. However, we have a thing called a genocide. And people throughout the history of the world have come up with 50 or a lot of different reasons as to why we should get rid of those people because they're different than us. So we go around figuring out why they're different. And we pick up on anything because we want to get rid of those people. So humans have a great way of rationalizing this as though they're really cleaning up things. I mean, Hitler was probably one of the most famous guys of how to clean up things. He went after people who were disabled in asylums because that's where they put disabled people in those days, in asylums.
Yep.
And he said, well, we got to get rid of those people because they're really incomplete. So people have always come up with great words to say, how should we get rid of those people? They're different from us. So we must be careful of what we believe in, because if we get further away from God, we get closer to the human side of things. And that's where we run into problems. If you don't have enough faith or belief, you start thinking your human values are more important, and therefore that's what I'm going to go by because it's a lot easier.
True.
No, life Quartal, is not...
I'm sorry. Quartal, any comment on this subject matter being discussed now?
Not right now.
Okay, so we'll move on quickly to duties of the heart, which I passed over, and I don't want to pass over because these teachings are so so powerful. And again, this is from Rabbeinu Bachya, who lived before the time of Rambam. And again, as I've asserted before, I believe Rambam would have had access to these teachings. And you can see some of this wisdom incorporated in his writings. And perhaps you might even find some of this incorporated into the Gadra of the Perplexed. This section is called Most People Need Inner Wisdom. Okay, so Rabbeinu Bachya asserts the following, and this is part of the introduction to his book, Duties of the Heart, Chovos Levovos. Perhaps the duties of the heart are so obvious and well known to all, I thought, at least I thought that, according to Rabbeinu Bachya, and people are so faithful in fulfilling them, that it was unnecessary to even write a book about these duties of the heart or duties of the limb in general. But when I made an inquiry into the conduct of previous generations as documented in written records, I found that the people were far removed from them, meaning the duties of the heart, the duties of the limbs of the human body, of course. Only the most fervent and outstanding personalities among the people lived up to these duties. As we know accounts of their conduct, the rest of the people ever sorely needed guidance and instruction in this area. How much more so in our generation? And this is, again, written 800 years ago, and I would say how much more so in our generation, in the 21st century. Most of the people do not take seriously the duties of the limbs of the body, certainly not the duties of the heart. Those among the people who are drawn to Torah study aim only to be considered scholars by the common people and to be thought as great men. They veer off the path of the Torah to study that which brings no excellence of character, does not correct personal faults and ignorance of which brings no punishment, while neglecting the study of the fundamentals of the faith and the foundations of the Torah, which should not be ignored or forsaken. Without knowledge of these fundamentals and foundations, and without practicing them, one simply cannot fulfill the commandments. Now, Dennis, you mentioned before that Lubavitch Rebbe was holding back or being, I'll re-paraphrase what he says, being politically correct. Well, Rabbeinu Bachya here is not being politically correct, to say the least.
That is correct, Don. Yeah. What happens is we must be direct with people, and we must keep reminding them that if you take the first step, there's a step after that and another step. It doesn't end. It isn't that now you feel good because you took the first step. You can take a vacation, wait a couple of years till your conscience fills up, and maybe go for the second step. That's being lazy. Humans are naturally lazy because you're putting off decision-making. If you know what is best for you and you have some common sense, you must use it. You may not be the most perfect person in the world, and you may never reach that level, but you must be able to go in the right direction. And that's why that sometimes it isn't the details that people do, it's the concepts that you must accept and be refreshed from time to time. If you don't, you're just going to sit back and say, well, I did my part, and I don't have to do any more. I can thank God once a week. It's okay. No, my friends, it's your life. You don't have a switch that says yes or no for religion. You don't have a switch for belief or faith. If you have it, practice it.
True. Karcho, any take on this matter?
Not right now.
Okay, so now we're going to go into the final segue of our show and then hopefully end off with a very social commentary-driven song by David Dohm, but we'll get to that soon, hopefully. And we're going now back to Genesis 2:25, blessed souls out there. This verse, probably brings up a lot of things and a lot of ideas to people, but perhaps the perspective we're going to share now with your blessed soul is something perhaps you have not considered, never would have considered, but might now start to consider according to the oral Torah traditions. But before we even get to this, we'll read the verse, and then we're going to go to a prophetic teaching about another dimension of nakedness or being bare. So again, let's just read the verse in chapter 2, verse 25 in Genesis. The two of them were naked, the man and his wife, and they were not ashamed. Now, I mentioned at the beginning of the show, if anyone did their homework, to look up two verses in Ezekiel chapter 16, verse 6 and 7, and it reads like this. By your blood shall you live. I caused you to thrive like plants of the field, and you increased and grew and became very adorned. Your bosom fashioned and your hair grown long, yet you were naked and bare. So, blessed, I want to point out, where it says, by your blood shall you live, is actually a verse, that prophetic verse from Ezekiel, is actually a verse that we read when we of the Jewish nation bring in a new Jewish boy into the covenant of Abraham. And according to what is something known as the Midrash, that there are two commandments which involve blood. Number one, there is the circumcision, which was demanded of the Jewish people at this point in time, from the time that they were going out of Egypt, and also the offering of the Paschal Lamb. And the Midrash brings out that, and I want to be very specific here, because I know some people read it the wrong way, because it's not any inference of superiority, but rather requirement or responsibility, because up until the point until the nation of Israel were where they were circumcised as a nation in full, meaning that generation that would leave Egypt and eventually go into the land of Israel, for them not to have been circumcised, for within the perspective of the Israelite people, this was considered to be a spiritual handicap. And also as well, until they were given the commandment of the Paschal Lamb, this is also a level of spiritual handicap. But being given those two commandments, this allows us to grow from that point on in our spirituality. Now, as well, in particular, the circumcision is considered to be a covenant. And what the point I want to bring out before we get to the concept of Adam and Eve being naked in the Garden of Eden, not ashamed, is that all human beings are bound by a covenant with the Almighty. And one just has to see with their own, pun intended, naked eyes, or you can have naked eyes through your naked eyeglasses, and look and see that there were covenants established between the Most High and Noah and his three sons before there was a Jewish people, an Israelite people, a Hebrew people. And one just has to go to chapter 9, verses 1 through 17, where the word covenant is mentioned several times. One just has to see that in the verses themselves. Now, going on to Adam and Eve being both naked and not ashamed. Now, at that particular time, let's remember, blessed souls, that, you know, we see later on after the sin, which hopefully we'll be learning in probably the next month or so on this humble effort here on Blog Talk Radio, that God spoke to them. If God spoke to them, it wasn't an act of faith that they responded. Like maybe this is, they knew quite clearly this was the Most High speaking to them, because if the Most High speaks to you and you are a prophet, it is just a communication. It's not an act of faith. You don't need any proof. There's no room for skepticism. But when the Most High speaks to you, you're pretty clear that who the one is speaking to you. Now, the thing is this, is that the idea that they were not ashamed is that it is brought down in the oral tradition that although they were both naked and not wearing clothes, they had no shame because they were not tempted by an evil urge. And with the same approach they took to eating food or walking through the garden was the same urge, was with the same approach they had being not wearing any clothes. Now, when they engaged in relations, because eventually they would have children in their initial environment, there was someone who became jealous of them, particularly Adam, and that was the serpent, who we'll be learning about in future weeks as well. So the idea of man and woman, original man and woman, being together is not of them being naked and not being ashamed is not testimony that they were brazen. It is not testifying to the fact that they were overly sensual. It's that their perception of how a human being was is totally disconnected to the way we look at human beings today as conscious beings, because their consciousness, because remember, they had no mother and father. They were the handiwork of the spiritual, the allegorical hands of the Most High. So I have a feeling that perhaps this is a new look for some people, because some people perhaps were accustomed to seeing this whole idea that two of them were naked and not ashamed, as it would appear through like a Hollywood perception or something where there's like a sort of like a libelous presentation of original men, women accentuating the sensuality of their initial experiences as human beings on the earth. So that's just something I want to share with you both, all of you out there, and then let's go to Dennis and Kochel for feedback. Dennis?
Well, they weren't ashamed because they were pure. They didn't think that there was anything wrong with the body because
right.
it came from God. So therefore, there's nothing bad there. There was no evil thinking. However, created animals, a lot of animals, and that fur would keep them warm or it would protect them from the sun, et cetera, et cetera. Humans, on the other hand, have a light hair on them that's in every little pore, but it's not enough to protect you from the sun nor the very cold weather. So that causes a dilemma here because when the weather gets cold, humans got to keep a little bit warm, so maybe they need to cover things. However, the other part is that since we are sentient beings, humans that have senses, eyes, ear, nose, mouth, taste, touch, we started pleasing ourselves because of our senses. So when you start looking at another person, your senses are heightened to a certain extent. I mean, if you look at a tree, all your senses don't have to work to take in the tree, to absorb the tree, what it represents. But another human is very, very curious. And sometimes this is where evil or the devil comes into play because they start thinking about it as this is a way to pleasure yourself to a certain degree so you'll feel better. And why not feel better? Well, I can go into the rationalization for this, but that's a waste of time. But anyhow, if we were sentient human beings, then certainly we're going to have feelings, and those feelings are expressed in different ways. But the other part is that, well, my personal opinion is, if every human on the planet didn't wear any clothes, most of the humans on the planet would be laughing most of the day. Because human bodies are the funniest things to look at when they have no clothes on. Because we know what parts are disproportionate, out of shape, and really bad looking. So that's where that funny part comes in. And to me, how many beautiful bodies are there? We have pictures of them. We have sculptures that Leonardo da Vinci made up and everything like this. Most bodies aren't that way. If you stand in a gym and watch people go in and out, you'll get a kick out of some of those bodies that are going in and out, and then you're going to see somebody that has beautiful, well-proportioned body, and you're going to say, what the blazes are they doing here? Have to come here. Look at all the other people. They're dragging themselves here. But human beings are funny in and of themselves, but they don't understand why they're funny, but we'll laugh. We'll enjoy the humor. It's when we start being skeptical, we start questioning things, and we start rationalizing things away. That's when we start getting in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Any comments on this issue? Cartrell?
Yes.
Yes. Any feedback you'd like to offer to the conversation?
Not at the moment. It's interesting.
Okay. Well, that being said, gentlemen, and bless those out there, we're going to conclude the show. It's actually that time of the show to wrap it up. And I want to wrap it up with the following story. You know, again, we've talked a lot tonight about the devastation and the tragedy and hopefully some of the hope and even some of the humor, as I say, accentuated by Jennifer Jeffries out in Little Ferry, New Jersey. And Jennifer, you're probably not going to hear this, but I call out to you and thank you for your strength. We're able to take the lemons that were given to you and turn it to lemonade. But I'm going to conclude the show right now, hopefully, with a song called The Wedding by David Dome. David Dome is a friend living out in England. And he wrote a song which has a lot of social commentary. I mean, all of us, I mean, I know in my particular culture, but I think in all cultures, we like to go to weddings because it's a new beginning. it's a joyous time. And most of us don't mind the good food and the drink and the music that we hear. We like to dance and get on the dance floor. However, this past Thursday, excuse me, I actually happened to attend a wedding. Now, it happened to be actually the daughter of my Rav, of Avram Taub, of Borough Park, the Borough Park section of Brooklyn, New York. And from the very beginning, and I just want to publicly thank Rav Taub for his guidance that I've received for the last couple of years, as advised by his older brother, lives in Atlit, Israel, which is actually a coastal town close to Haifa. The idea of this splendid attribute that he publicly displays to greet everyone with a cheery countenance. But the night of the wedding, there was a sense of joy because, again, it's the beginning of a new life, hopefully new family, new children, new grandchildren, etc., even great-grandchildren for the two families. However, there was also a sense that, you know, we're glad to be alive, you know, and we're going to... So there was a joy, but there was also a humility that I have not experienced at other weddings, like a new beginning. Perhaps a type of sensing of new beginning that might have been felt at, say, like Holocaust survivors who made a wedding in 1946, or perhaps the feeling a young American couple where the husband had served in World War II and lost most of his buddies, if not all of his buddies, in a particular platoon, or the bride had lost a brother or a sister in the military, or perhaps if we go back into ancient history, if we go back to the weddings which took place between the children of Noah after the flood, and Noah had three sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth, and eventually they had children. And when their children get married, one could sense perhaps there was a sense of joy and humility at those weddings. But with that being said, I want to now segue to this song called The Wedding, where David mentions in the chorus to the songs, help me to see the good. So let us all pray, blessed souls, that through this trying time that just was incurred by the good citizens of the five boroughs of New York and the 21 states in America, and the truth is, it really affects the whole nation right now, and it has an international impact upon all nations because everyone has seen the mighty hand of the Most High. And again, we're not going to say why, but we're just going to advocate that we get more involved in the human family experience of kindness and acts of brotherly and sisterly and human love, that let us merit to help each other see the good that can come even out of a tragedy. And hopefully this tragedy will lead to only more good, and hopefully that good in the way of a hava chad, one love, goral chad, one destiny, kolonu for all of us, b'darchi shalom, in a peaceful way, darchi noam, in a pleasant way, with the help of us accessing our Tzelem Elohim, divine image, which is no dream, which will help us get off in scrimmage, to have more meaningful encounters with the Most High and each other on this planet. Lahamshich, to be continued, Be'ezer Hashem, with the help of the Most High. Take care, everyone.
Good night.
Conversation is flowing, the music is playing, and speeches are all set on time. I try to relax with this small talk at large, discomfort with having to pretend that you're happy to see me, and I'm happy to see you, when we both know it's a meet till the end. Because you're talking about TV and the latest movie, opinions are easy, but there's not enough. Desserts are amazing and the coffee is fine, and only the best is gonna do. The food keeps on coming in, it seems never ending. Is this what it means to be a Jew? I don't sense the Shekinah when it should be here, resting above me and you. And now he's praising his mother and he's thanking the father, but no mention of a ship is coming. There's laughter and singing and guitars are ringing. A wonderful evening, but there's not enough about God. Help me to see. Help me to see. forget that everything we have comes from Him. Our wives and our children, not making a living, can we forget Hashem on them? I see kids falling distant outside on show, but are they connected from our hearts? Please try to remember that Hashem is the lender, and it's only to Him that we owe. Let's have laughter and singing, and guitars ringing, have a wonderful evening, but let's not forget about God.
Oh boy.
It's a wonderful evening, but it's not enough for us.